Welcome to the latest edition of the Sea Control Podcast, your moment of PowerPoint rehab from the Center for International Maritime Security. As always, I am your semi-helpful host and president of here at SIMSEC, Matthew Hipple. So today we have a treat. If, as many of you likely have not had the chance to go out to the USNA Naval Museum, that's the United States Naval Academy, they have an exhibit going on until January of Warrior Writers, which is it's almost a record of the intellectual history of the United States Navy since 1873, when USNI was started with proceedings. And it's very exciting. And Claude Berube, famous author, friend of the podcast, and the director of the Naval Museum at Annapolis, will be with us today to discuss that exhibit and his new book coming out. So lots of fun topics. Claude's a smart, fun guy, too. As I see here on Skype, he's drinking himself a fine red wine, so I'm assuming that'll loosen him up a bit, so maybe he'll tell us at some point what he's drinking. But before we get to all the fun, let's take a quick break for a short word from my wife.
SIMSEC brings you the best content on maritime security, technology, history, and international affairs. And, like the United States, SIMSEC is and always will be free. Sign up to become a member today by visiting www.cimsec.org/about/membership, which gets you daily emails of our articles and a WordPress account that sends your own writings directly to our editorial staff. However, admin, special projects, software, events, and prizes do cost money. There is a new option to make a voluntary monthly donation at the bottom of every SIMSEC article. No matter how you choose to support us, those who volunteer for leadership, our amazing content producers, our readers, our listeners, our conference planners and attendees, and our financial benefactors, we are incredibly grateful. Remember, Sea Control is more than just a podcast, and SIMSEC is more than just a website. We are a vibrant community built on a passion for discovery and discussion. Sign up, write, donate, comment, or even leave 5 stars on our iTunes page. Join us today.
And we're back. Well, we are, as I said, here with Claude Berube. And Claude, as we do every time with every guest, I would like you to take a moment to give the audience a feel for who you are, where you're coming from, the important beats in your life and your career that you think are necessary for them to understand the man that they are listening to today.
Sure. Thanks, Matt. It's a pleasure to be with you. I don't know if it's a jack of all trades or somebody who hasn't been able to hold down a job, but I've worked on Capitol Hill for 2 senators, one from each party. I had a fellowship with the Brookings Institute and a fellowship with the Heritage Foundation as a maritime security studies fellow. I've worked as a defense contractor in the 90s for about 7 years for NAVC as well as Office of Naval Research. As an officer in the Navy, I've served overseas with EUCOM. I was the Sea Combat Commander N2 aboard the USS Bunker Hill when she deployed 2004-2005. And have served as a civilian with ONI as well, working on terrorism issues. And for the past 10 years, both on active duty and as a civilian, I've worked with at-risk youth at a public school in Annapolis. And I think many of your listeners are probably graduates of the Naval Academy. So, and I also
hope they caught that. Well, let's start at the beginning. I gave the audience a bit of a feel for what your exhibit is. So you walk into this exhibit at the museum. You see plaques that record every decade in which the proceedings has been in existence and describing some of the articles, some of the thoughts. There's a lot of exhibits, both from war and from academic pursuits. You even stole B.J. Armstrong's Nook and shoved that in a glass case so he can't get to it. I thought that was
he
quite
excellent. He still hasn't been able to read anything. It's terrible. He's fighting it for his life.
What inspired you to do this project? Where did this exhibit come from? What was its inspiration? And sort of talk a little bit about the process of getting to this point.
Sure. The genesis came about in 2007. I was teaching in the political science department, and I used to have these evening forums with young authors One particular evening, I had Nate Fick, who wrote One Bullet Away. He had been a Marine captain in Iraq and Afghanistan. Craig Mullaney, Captain Craig Mullaney, U.S. Army, West Point graduate, who wrote The Unforgiving Minute and was teaching in the history department at the academy at the time. And David Dinello, a Naval Academy graduate, 1998, who was a Marine in Iraq. And he had written Blood Stripes, The Grunt's View of the War in Iraq. And this panel was moderated by Dick Couch, a very noted author. We held it in Mitchell Auditorium for the Naval Academy graduates listening to the podcast. And that night, now, the midshipmen have a lot of requirements. And usually you have to require a class to attend something or a forestall lecture. The entire brigade is required to attend a forestall. Nobody was required to attend this warrior writers panel that I had. And that's how it was billed. The evening was incredible. We filled Mitcher Auditorium with midshipmen. They weren't there to listen to them talk about their experiences as officers in Iraq and Afghanistan. The panel spoke about the art and the practice of writing for an hour. And the midshipmen stayed for an hour. They stayed an hour and a quarter, an hour and a half, until some actually had to go do, I think plebes had to leave at about 2000 as was required. But afterward, a lot of these upperclassmen just stayed and just gravitated toward these young authors. And I realized that what was resonating with the midshipmen is that these authors weren't technically that much older than them. They weren't the 50, 60, 70, 80-year-old writers or whomever who normally speak at the Naval Academy. This was their generation, more or less, that was telling them about their experiences. So that was really the genesis of it. So fast forward 2012, I was made the interim director of the Naval Academy Museum. I had my last year of a recall on active duty. And then the following year, I was made civilian director of the museum. And at that point, I said, I need to do something with this. I had worked with about 1,000 midshipmen at that point in the classroom. And I really wanted to try to foster and inspire them to write about their careers, about issues. What I found most enlightening for myself in the classroom was to these are midshipmen from all around the country, all around the world, and I always learn something from my midshipmen. So I wanted to make sure that they understood that's an incredible heritage they have. So one of the missions of the Naval Academy Museum is to instill in midshipmen a sense of their heritage. So the museum exhibit, I felt, as I was trying to think, how do I do this? How do I portray this? And I decided that I would use the Naval Institute as the medium for telling the story of their heritage. Because although officers have written in many different with many different publishers and many different magazines, even going back to the 1830s and the Naval Lyceum's Naval Magazine and other publications, the story of the Naval Institute allowed me to tell this story better. It allowed me to research the names better, the articles, and to determine what we had in the museum. So the three reasons why I put this together: number one, to inspire midshipmen to write about issues and challenges about sea power and the Navy and the Marine Corps. The second reason was for us to, as a museum, to inform the public, which is also a mission of ours. And we get about 100,000 visitors a year, including about 5,000 to 7,000 international visitors. And the third reason was to show artifacts that we wouldn't normally show or had never shown before. We have 58,000 artifacts in the Naval Academy Museum. We show maybe 2,000 or 3,000 at any one time. So this was a very important way for us to identify some artifacts that might be interesting. About 60% of the artifacts in this exhibit are from the Naval Academy Museum. And it's tougher for us to have items from the past 40 or 50 years because of the War Trophies Act from the Vietnam War. And the fact that, you know, the generation who normally bequeaths a lot of artifacts to us, it simply hasn't happened yet. So it gave us an opportunity really to look at these artifacts, and my staff and I learned a little bit more about the artifact, some of which had never been really looked at before by in years, decades. So that's how we came about to do this. And I approached Naval Institute maybe about a year ago, letting them know, this is what I'm going to do. I need your help. I'm looking for X, Y, and Z. And they were extraordinary in helping us out in providing the background information on some of their authors and providing some of the artifacts themselves.
So let's actually talk about that before we get into – so you're the curator, obviously, so there is a flow, a purpose, and a message to the exhibit.
Sorry, just to clarify, we do have a couple of curators, but I'm the director of the museum. So a curator will actually work hands-on with the artifacts. The director has overall control of the museum and the entire business.
You have a series of artists, let's say, that have spread these artifacts and have created the message and have created this narrative in the space. Creating a narrative in a space. I feel like a hippie, but it's true. It's correct use of language. But before we get into that, the sort of more artful and overall message, let's get into some of those artifacts. I noticed a series of them there. We talked about B.J. Armstrong's Nook. But what are some of your favorites? What are the ones that are in there that you thought were really interesting?
Okay. A few of the artifacts. The first case that visitors will see is a pen and sword case. We've got about, I think it's six swords, that the swords of General Wallace Greene, United States Marine Corps. We have the Tiffany sword of Richard Wainwright, who had been a superintendent of the Naval Academy and author for Proceedings. His son was a Medal of Honor recipient. The Wainwright family actually has an extraordinary history of military service to the country from the Civil War to World War II. I think it was his grandson who commanded the troops through the March of Bataan. And this sword is usually kept in a secure vault because it's a Tiffany sword. It's one of only a couple that we have. The pens range from one that was used by Nimitz for signing the surrender treaty at the end of World War II. We have one that's more current with Captain Jerry Hendricks, who wrote a seminal article for Proceedings called "By Fords, Not Ferraris." We have Admiral Rickover's pen set, and right to the lower left.
Is there
left
any blood on that pen set?
Yes. What I thought was most fascinating out of that case was something I pulled out, and it was Ernie Pyle's writing kit. And Ernie Pyle was an embedded journalist. He was a friend of the Marine Corps. He was with them throughout the Pacific. He'd been in the European theater as well. But he was a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, and we came across his writing kit because his aide in the Pacific gathered his belongings after he was killed by the Japanese. And one of the things I learned about that was Ernie Pyle had been a Navy reservist toward the end of World War I. So I thought this was a great example to show the journalism aspect. We have the very first editorial board book, the notes taken for the first few decades of USNI. USNI loaned it to us, and in fact, when I was chair of the editorial board of Proceedings, I would often look through the pages and read, and it's extraordinary because you look and realize that some of the same issues that they dealt with, say, in the 1870s or the 1920s are the same issues really that we deal with today. It's about strategies, about platforms, about personnel, tactics, operations, technology. One of the paintings that is actually my favorite, is by Logan Ramsey, is of Logan Ramsey. He was a lieutenant commander in the 1930s and wrote several articles about aerial attacks on fleets at anchor. Well, in 1941, he's serving as lieutenant commander at Pearl Harbor on December 7th and issues the message, "Pearl Harbor is under attack. This is no drill." And I like this story because he ends up being an admiral in World War II, commanding carrier. And his son becomes a naval aviator as well, Logan Ramsey Jr., and after the war becomes an actor. He was in the movie Scrooged with Bill Murray. That's the one I best remember him from. But he was also in a very famous episode of Star Trek, the old series, where he was a Roman emperor in an Earth-like Roman Empire. But he had a very lengthy acting career. We have Admiral Richard Byrd's hand generator that he used in his Antarctic expedition and he writes about. We have so many items, and even The person I think who was extraordinarily supportive was Admiral Stavridis, who is the only individual to have written for proceedings at every rank from midshipman right through four-star admiral. So he loaned us his four-star shoulder boards. He loaned us 20 of the more than 400 pens that he collects, and that was a great addition to it. And he was very kind in providing a note to the midshipman. You know, I like to write fountain pen or ballpoint. We have a Hunt for Red October board game because Naval Institute Press published was the publisher of the Hunt for Red October. And even though Clancy didn't serve in the military, I think it was important to show him as well and the role of the Naval Institute, because prior to him, a lot of people read the Hunt for Red October, and a lot of people saw the movie. And prior to that, people didn't realize, wow, what are these Typhoon class submarines or LA class submarines? And you know, I hate to say, almost like Top Gun, people had a little better understanding of some of the things that the Navy does did on a day-to-day basis. You know, you mentioned B.J. Armstrong's Nook. Next to his Nook are the original notes that Jerry Hendrix wrote while he was on deployment for By Fords, Not Ferraris. And below that is a Moleskine notebook, one of the many that David Dinello carried with him in Iraq, where he's taking extraordinary notes on people he meets, places he goes. You know, it's the sights, the sounds, the smells, and he uses that as the basis of a book. We have Nimitz's SDV jacket framed, and the other shoulder boards we have are the Lieutenant J.G. shoulder boards of John S. McCain Sr., and he's the first of four generations of John McCain's to go through the United States Naval Academy. So those are really just a few of the artifacts that we have, and I think we've been very fortunate. We have two father-son pairings. We have, obviously, the Beaches, Ed Beach Sr., who wrote 13 novels for young adults but had written for proceedings. And we have Ed Beach Jr., who, while he was the naval aide to Eisenhower, went home and wrote Run Silent, Run Deep, one of the seminal mid-20th century naval novels. And, of course, the Naval Institute is at Beach Hall. They have been since 1999 up at Hospital Point at the Naval Academy. What people don't realize is that the Naval Institute was founded by junior officers in 1873 at the Naval Academy. And fortunately, they had a superintendent like John Warden, a senior officer who would foster and mentor these young officers and presided over the first meeting of the Institute. And they were there in various offices until 1939, and they helped build the museum building, which is now – it's been called Preble Hall for the past 45 years. But they shared spaces with us from 1939 to 1999. So there's a very long history of the Naval Institute and the Naval Academy, as well as certainly the Naval Academy Museum. So again, we get back to this continuity of ideas and how junior officers, mostly junior officers, I want to say about half of the authors for proceedings, at least for the first 50 years and certainly for the past couple of decades, have been junior officers. I did a study of that about 3 or 4 years ago. And so that's a very important storyline. And that's why I tell my midshipmen that, you know, don't be impressed by Admiral Ernest King. Don't be impressed by Admiral Chester Nimitz. Of course, when they wrote, people listen, but nobody listened to them. You know, they didn't have a name when they wrote as a Lieutenant JG or an ensign or a lieutenant. That's when they wrote their prize winning essays for proceedings. These are the people who started off thinking and writing. And I've told the classes that have gone through this exhibit since September 10th that you are Lieutenant J.G. Nimitz. You are Second Lieutenant Lejeune. So that's really what we're trying to get across to the midshipmen and to the general public, and informing them how the Navy has identified challenges and written about them and thought about these issues. We're not automatons. We are thinking about the challenges, and certainly there are challenges before us today. And there's, you know, the theme of technology. And I do mention you and Scott Cheney Peters in that there's a new generation. I've called this before at DEF Annapolis last year the three eras of naval enlightenment. And these are what you might consider surges in junior officers' expanding beyond the normal means of thinking and writing about issues. The first era I call is the 1830s, when you had the Naval Lyceum developed by junior officers and Master Commandant Matthew Perry, and they developed Naval Magazine. So that's the first time that junior officers are writing in a publication, whether under their own names or under pseudonyms. The second era of the surge or enlightenment was the 1870s through the 1890s, when you had proceedings, when they started talking about, hey, we need a war school, as Stephen Belew suggests. We need a naval war college. And he goes on to found the Naval War College. And he says, we need merchant marine academies, and Congress and the states agree. So this first few decades of Naval Institute is extremely important. And then it's not to say that there aren't ideas like that, but it was simply a surge, this creation of three different eras. And the third era is what we're seeing today. I'd say for the past 4 or 5 years, you see this obviously with SIMSEC and with DEF or DEF Annapolis. That was just a one-off. But, you know, these are the things that we're starting to see. And I'm very hopeful when I see these things happening, that people are thinking and writing. And that's what we got to get across to the midshipmen, and that's what we got to get across to the public, that there are challenges in the maritime sphere today that we must overcome.
But what you do in the exhibit itself is we break down, I think there's about 15 plaques, a decade,
right,
where you take down, you take from the point where proceedings and the USNI came into existence in one form or another. And you record and give a character to each one of those decades of writing. And a lot of those plaques, before we get into the specifics and what you think that ebb and flow is, a lot of those plaques, it's amusing to see how so much of what we write about today, or the themes that we write about today, and you know, young guys like me are like, oh, I'm thinking of something so clever. No, you're not. It's it's been spoken about in ye olde English about 150 years ago. And one of the artifacts that I thought most interesting outside of John Ripley Box of Beast Mode was actually a letter from Theodore Roosevelt, which to me sounded exactly like an online comment from an article. It says, it's a letter to R.U. Johnson, Esquire, at Century Magazine, New York. It says, Dear Mr. Johnson, here's the article, and I hope you will like it, but the fact is that the title is foolish. Modern is a relative term. Those ironclads were modern 15 or 20 years ago. They are not modern now. Faithfully yours, Theodore Roosevelt. If you take the deer and the faithfully yours away, that sounds exactly like something someone would say today. So let's talk about how, what are those different ages? What do you see as those ebb and flow, those 15 different plaques, and how do you see them kind of match a lot of the discussion that we have today?
Mm-hmm. You know, it's funny. You see during peacetime, junior officers talking about, hey, I want to get out of the, or why are junior officers getting out of the Navy? You know, and this might be the 1920s or 1930s or 1950s, or there's an extraordinary prescience about technology, whether it's about in the 1880s, hey, how do this new thing, electricity, how do we incorporate that into ships, or torpedoes, which had been certainly better, I think at least developed more by the Russians, like Admiral Makarov, Stepan Makarov. And again, I don't mean to say that there was no enlightenment in naval thought between those periods I mentioned. Simply, there was simply surges that caused a creation of these organizations. The decades are, it's fascinating because the junior officers and civilians like Theodore Roosevelt at the time seem to excel in periods of when there wasn't war, or at least major conflict, I should say. They really took a hard look. I mean, it's easy to talk about what you need during a war. It's much harder in the 1870s in the aftermath of the Civil War. It's much more difficult in the 1900s prior to World War I to talk about the role of the Navy in the world. It's much more difficult in the 1920s when you had Kellogg-Briand or the 1930s when, you know, we had a Great Depression and who knows what was going to go on at that point. So I think the authors tended to be far more creative during those periods. As you mentioned, there's a panel or section for each decade of naval thought. And what we do is we really summarize in a couple of very brief paragraphs what the decade was about. What were the challenges? We talk about a few of the key authors that we thought, but there's so many more. And we provide a few pictures on those panels of the authors, especially the Naval Academy graduates. And I should mention that in the first 40 or 50 years of the exhibit, it's mostly Naval Academy graduates, because certainly that was the nature. They were the ones who, that was the primary source of the officer corps during that time period. So now in the past 30 or 40 years, you have more ROTC or OCS or other sources for officers who are writing as well. So I think that's the big takeaway, that people do rise to the occasion when called upon, when the challenges are truly there. That's when they get creative. That's when they get, dare I say, innovative.
So speaking of which, we're talking about warrior writers. We've talked about the artifacts. We've talked about the sort of ebb and flow of the ideas. Now let's talk about a warrior writer, because you have in about 6 weeks. Your new book is coming out. It's A Siren Song. It is the second in the Connor Stark novel. It involves Sri Lankans and EMPs and all sorts of other madness. So talk about first, how did you get into writing yourself? At what point did you sit down and say, hey, you know what, this is something that I want to do?
Sure. It really started as a kid. Neither of my parents had gone to college, but they were both extremely literate. We had a library in my house, and so they were both very self-educated. So we had a lot of history books, and we had a lot of political books and international relations books in the house. My dad was a veteran of World War II, so we had a lot of those. And even as a kid, you know, we had a swimming pool, and I would go for laps in the summer, and I'd come out of the pool and, read one of the books on World War II battleships that I picked up at the local library. So I've always had an interest in reading, and I always wanted to write. And right after college, I knew I wanted to write novels, and I tried my hand at it. It wasn't anything. So I really knew that I needed life experience, but I loved history, too. So I ended up writing more nonfiction than anything else. I think the first article was published maybe 99 or 2000. So I was about in my early 30s when the first one came out. My first three books were on nonfiction and naval history, Congress. And I started to look around about the world around me, and I wrote or co-edited the third book, which was on private maritime security companies. And my theory that I had written about for several years, starting with the Naval War College, about how these companies, PSCs, would gravitate from Iraq and Afghanistan to other maritime threats. At that time, the rising piracy threat. So that's why I wrote about nonfiction, but I always wanted to write fiction. I tried my hand in the late 90s and wrote a manuscript featuring John Connor Stark. And the reason why I named my protagonist Connor Stark is because my senior thesis in college was about the American Revolutionary War hero, General John Stark, who most famously wrote, "Live free or die, death is not the greatest of evils." And that's the official state motto of New Hampshire. So that's how I got started. And then, about a decade or so ago, I really wanted to take up fiction again. And I figured, why can't I write both nonfiction and fiction at the same time? And I went back to some of the characters that I had originally developed in the late 90s. And found the right storyline, and it turned into the Aden Effect, and it was about Somali piracy and a crisis in Yemen.
And why don't you talk a little bit about your newest book, Siren Song? So I have the advanced uncorrected proof. It looks incredibly exciting. I could give a little description of the book, what I have here on the flavor page in the back, but I'd rather turn it over to you and just have you kind of describe what you think folks need to know about the book, kind of where it's going, a little bit of the flavor that's in it, and some of the things that inspired you to write this book in particular.
Sure, I'll take that last question first. And what I decided to do with this series, excuse me, the Connor Stark series, which is published by Naval Institute Press, I have to mention that, that I wanted to look not at the big wars, but I'd written a couple of articles for Small Wars Journal. So these books are really about small wars at sea. They're about maritime non-state actors and non-governmental organizations. So the first book, in part, dealt with Connor Stark, who's been recalled to active duty and is in the Navy again, and deals with Somali pirates. In the second book, he has returned to civilian life and is now back to heading his private security company, Highland Maritime Defense. And he is operating under a letter of marque for the Sri Lankan government, which has faced some challenges with a resurgence in the Sea Tigers. And that's where we really pick up where Connor Stark is. And you will see, if you've read, your listeners have read the first book, The Aiden Effect, a number of the characters are back. Some of them have far larger roles than they did in The Aiden Effect. Some of them have far smaller roles. But, you know, the old crew is back. Damian Golzari, the diplomatic security agent who, you know, I thought was going to be the Jar Jar Binks of this series, but turns out that he's like one of the favorite characters of people who read this book. You know, and so many others, but it is primarily a Navy book. There's a private security company book. There is a Navy destroyer that's featured, but you really deal with the Sea Tigers and how they're, in this case, how they're doing a resurgence and how to separate and how to attack the Sri Lankan government. And so I think it was important. I think it's important to tell those stories in my books. I think. A lot of people do very well with the big war books. I think Ghost Fleet did a wonderful job in showing us the dangers inherent with new technologies as well as the benefits of war with China. But China is in the background of these books. I do deal with the small wars, but there is a big long-term picture. In fact, you meet a Chinese character in the first book very, very briefly here and there. But he has an expanded role in this book. So there really is a geopolitical aspect to these novels, and I hope to write them for, you know, a long time.
Well, I'm excited to read it. I promise to be gentle here, since I did get a free book out of the deal. But what recommendations do you have then? So you've written, guys like you and BJ have encouraged folks like me to write and Scott to write. And out of that really poor decision on your part, you now have SimSec floating around now. So what is your recommendation to folks who do want to write? Now, I'll kind of throw something out there myself. And it seems that a lot of us that write have inspired others to write, but that some do not find the mentorship and the guidance that some of us are lucky enough to have. And you can see that where folks just come out and they say, ah, F this play, so I'm going to mic drop, or this sucks and that sucks. And there's a certain point where writing is an art. You know, there's some tact involved. You're trying to communicate to an audience and you're trying to make them feel something or understand something or to change something. And what I would encourage folks is that the passion to write is very good. But it can be a very dangerous is the wrong word, but can be a very powerful force, and that you should seek folks to guide you and to train you who have done this before, so that you do not taint your reputation or taint the craft itself. The folks that do that sort of maybe drive people away, and when they see stuff like that. So I guess that would be my initial recommendation: is that if you want to write, and especially if you are pushed by passion to write, that you find someone to be your strategic corporal, if you will, and make sure that you're not saying or doing something that's perhaps a little bit tactless or needs some further guidance. But with that long and unnecessary monologue by the host, I will turn it over to the actual guest that we're here to listen to. And Claude, what's your advice for folks who want to write and get engaged?
Well, first, find what you like to write about. Find the types of books you like to read. For example, for my novels, I had been reading for decades, and I think I was most influenced by authors, novelists in the late 1980s. You know, yeah, Clancy was an influence, but he actually wasn't the primary influence. I was struck more by William F. Buckley, who, you know, you all know as the founder of National Review, but fewer people know that he wrote a very good historical novel series, thrillers, called the Blackford Oak series. Bill Granger, who wrote the November Man series back in the 70s and 80s, you know, even people like Catherine Neville, and, you know, she was one of my heroes. She wrote The Eight, which was an extraordinary historical thriller, and ended up meeting her at an author's dinner just a few months ago for the very first time in my life. And, you know, I think that was the first time I was really starstruck. So I think find authors that you enjoy to read. Find a niche for yourself. Travel is probably one of the best forms of education, not only around the United States, but around the world. Focus. I always tell my students, especially as they're heading into at Naval War College, for example, I think the best opportunity to write and eventually publish in the nonfiction realm are your research papers. For example, I wrote a research paper for Naval War College, and it was about, Admiral Mullen at the time. And I took issue with his concept of a 1,000-ship Navy. And I basically ripped it apart in my Naval War College course. And I had a mentor, Dr. Stan Weeks. He'd been a retired captain. And I said, sir, I don't know if I can write this. Should I? He said, absolutely, write it. You know, just go with it. I did. And I ended up publishing it. There was another mentor I found. Ran it by him, and he said, here, I think you should send it to Orbis. So I said, it was in Orbis as Black Waters for the Blue Waters, the Promise of Private Naval Companies. And that led to a series of articles in my niche on private maritime security companies and, of course, the third book. So I would say to any of your listeners, when you're at war college, when you're in college, when you are wherever, if you are writing a paper for a class, do it with the intention that you want to push this article out somewhere. Maybe it's the USNI blog. Maybe it's SimSec. Maybe it's Cosmopolitan Magazine or Esquire. Who knows? But think about that. If you're looking for mentors, find an organization. USNI has an opportunity to contact them, say, look, I'm looking for this kind of writer. How can I get matched up? Or SimSec. There's a new organization called Military Writers Guild. But there are plenty of opportunities for officers and junior officers and midshipmen, et cetera, to identify. I would also say it's really important you go to writers' conferences. These are held all over the United States. Some of them are smaller conferences. Some are, you know, I go to the International Thriller Writers Conference in New York almost every year. There's another one, BoucherCon, that's now held, I think it's in Raleigh this year. But you get panels from the experts and you learn. I mean, I still learn the craft of writing a novel. I'm hoping that my second novel is better than my first. That's my intention. And I want my third novel to be better. It's the same thing with my nonfiction. I listen to my editors and I try to do better. So that's what I would. Those are some of the suggestions I would make.
And speaking of suggestions, since we're coming up to the end of our time, unfortunately, let's talk about drink suggestions. So not to steal a page from the War on the Rocks podcast, which is exactly what I'm doing right now. What is it that you are drinking? What is your potent potable of choice at the moment?
Mad Dog 2020. No.
It's not Night Train. What's the price? No, what is it? What's the price? 30 twice. What's the word? Thunderbird.
There's nothing wrong with those. They're very cost effective. I came from parents who grew up in the Great Depression and told me to be very cost conscious about things. No, this is a French red wine, but normally I drink scotches. I love Talisker, Highland Park. Highland Park is one of the two distilleries on the island of Orkney. That and Scapa. I tend to prefer. There are a number of different scotches, but I tend to prefer the island malts. I just find them far more flavorful. I find them far more distinct than the Speyside scotches. So, in fact, I'm looking at my whiskey hutch now, and I'm looking at the 30-odd bottles of single malt scotch that I have to collect. Not like I drink them very often. It's just I like to have them once in a while. I've actually come to enjoy recently Manhattans. I don't know what it is. I was at a bar in Annapolis with Lucien Gauthier. A few weeks ago, and he was a CT and a member of SimSec and a wonderful writer and thinker and probably one of the best read individuals in the Navy today, and we were just having a burger, and I decided to go with a Manhattan because that was one of the specialties of this particular bar. Summer, I like gin and tonics. I usually get Bombay Sapphire. And I actually like white Russians in the winter.
So I was a white Russian man myself until I married into tequila. And now pretty much it's wall-to-wall tequila and or margaritas for me when it comes to the liquors. Though everyone uses sour. So if anyone's listening, the actual way you make a margarita and the way to request it when you go to the restaurant is you say, I want tequila. I prefer reposado. Some people like silver. Orange juice, lime juice, and agave. That's it. It's simple. You're not using weird sour mixes. You're not putting pomegranate in there. And ask for like a real salt rim, because sometimes I think people just rub dry glasses in salt, and you got one or two grains up there, but it kills it. But what I am drinking at the moment, I do not recommend, unless you are looking for pure effect here. So, as you enjoy products of Scotland, I am also drinking a product of Scotland. It is, no, I am not done. My lovely wife is here. You heard her previously on the announcement. Say hello.
Hi.
Okay. I am drinking BrewDog's Tokyo, spelled with an I. It's called Intergalactic Fantastic Oak Age Stout. It is not any of those. But if it's any indicator, it is not listed as a beer, though it's in a beer bottle, and it is advertised as, or you know, it looks like a beer. They're obviously trying to give it a beer look, but it's an 18.2% by volume flavored malt liquor. It says malt beverage brewed with cranberries and jasmine. It tastes like none of those things. I just like beers that you can't see through. So I thought, oh, well, give this a try. No. Kind of just tastes like a little bit like dirt, like flavory dirt. But, you know, it's a party foul to get rid of it, so I'll keep it here. Anyways, before we go, then, if Claude, you have any final words you wish to pass to our lovely audience, let's have those and then let them be on their way.
Sure. I would encourage you, if you are visiting Annapolis, to look us up at the U.S. Naval Academy Museum, located in Preble Hall, just inside of Gate 3. The Warrior Writers exhibit is open. It's now open through 31 January of 2016. So you have plenty of opportunities to bring to come on over and check it out. We're open 362 days a year, except for Thanksgiving, Christmas, and New Year's. You can also check out a few of our items. We're posting a few videos and photos on Facebook. We also have a series of of talks, the Scheife Lecture Series, and this semester are focusing on Naval Institute authors to coincide with the Warrior Writer exhibit, including our first poet, Virginia Kelly, who wrote When Men Go Off to War. So she'll be speaking, I think, in late October, early November, but you can check our website. It's usna.edu/museum.
Excellent. And I will also, since you are so humble and didn't do so yourself, plug that Siren song. And that is spelled with a Y. Siren, spelled with a Y. The Connor Stark novel is now available for purchase. Not now, but, you know, pre-purchase, all that kind of stuff. On Amazon, and in case you haven't heard of that, it is www.amazon.com. It's some kind of book selling website, I'm not sure. But I would also recommend that if you are on the East Coast and you are in Norfolk, I recommend you look up Athena East on Facebook. That is Athena East, because we will be having a innovation competition right here in Norfolk down at Work Release, which is downtown. It's a really cool entertainment venue. We're going to have audience voting prizes. We'll have some stuff from 757 Makerspace and a local improv comedy theater, which does lessons. And we also have a Shark Tank board, not angry Mark Cuban screaming at people kind of Shark Tank, more mentorship Shark Tank. But we're talking about leaders from the waterfront who, if they hear interesting ideas, may wish to implement them themselves. So if you have something you wish to submit, that is athenanavy@gmail.com. And outside of that, don't drink Tokyo beer. It's gross. Claude likes scotch. He recommends that. And I think that's pretty much all we've got today. So, Claude, I really appreciate you being on the podcast.
All right. Thanks for having me. Pleasure.